Hello, and welcome to our online press conference. My name is Tom Pelton, and I'm Director of Communications for the Environmental Integrity Project. We're a 19-year-old nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. and Austin, Texas, that is dedicated to enforcing environmental laws and strengthening public policy to protect public health and the environment. Today, we're joined by five allied organizations from Louisiana, Texas, Alabama, and the Ohio River Valley in Kentucky and West Virginia. We are releasing a new Environmental Integrity Project report titled Environmental Justice and Refinery Pollution. It's available on our website at www.environmentalintegrity.org. We're going to have six speakers today, and then we're going to open it up to questions from reporters. To avoid background sounds, please everyone keep yourself on mute until it's your turn to speak or ask a question. Our first speaker will be Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project and former Director of Civil Enforcement at EPA. He's co-author of the report we're releasing today. And with us today is also EIP staff engineer Ben Kunstman, who will be with us to answer questions about the report. Next, we'll have Ann Rolfes, Director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. Next, John Beard, founder of the Port Arthur Community Action Network in Texas. Next, Patricia Gonzalez, founder of Caring for Pasadena Communities, located just outside of Houston. Next, we'll have Cade Kistler, program director of the Mobile Baykeeper in Alabama. And finally, Danny Parent, communications co-director with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, based in Kentucky and West Virginia. After all our speakers are done, we'll open up to questions and answers from reporters. So let's get started. Eric Schaefer, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks, Tom. I want to welcome everyone and a special thanks to our guest speakers. By the end of 2020, we had 13 refineries reporting annual benzene levels above the amounts that are considered acceptable under a Clean Air Act rule. And those levels are, the reported levels are based on the concentrations of benzene that refineries measure along the boundary of their plants. So that's where the data comes from. It is publicly reported, and our report tells you where to get it and how to read it. Five of the plants with those unacceptable levels of benzene were in Louisiana, three in Texas, two in New Mexico, one each in Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and Alabama. So when benzene levels get as high as they did in 2020 for these 13 plants, the rule requires refiners to turn around, find out where that benzene is coming from, and clean up the emission sources until you get benzene concentrations below the level that's considered acceptable. So these plants have work to do. And I just want to flag that seven of them also reported exceeding, you know, what EPA calls the action level, the unacceptable level in 2019. So especially for those seven plants, there's a lot of pressure on them to get their benzene numbers down because they've been too high for too long. Just a little more background on why this issue matters. Benzene's found in oil. It's not surprising to see it leak out of chemical plants. You're always going to have a little bit of benzene in the air around refineries and chemical plants for that matter. But it's also a very potent carcinogen. If you get exposed over a lifetime to just a few parts per billion of benzene, you're at increased risk of getting leukemia, a terrible disease, and dying from it. Benzene will also form smog. It attacks your respiratory system, and especially if you've been struggling with a pandemic, the last thing you need is more benzene in the air. It's also very volatile, very hard to contain. When gasoline or other oil-based products and chemicals are exposed to the air, the benzene will turn into vapor pretty quickly. That's why when you're filling up at a gas station, you get that kind of sticky sweet smell. that's benzene finding its way into your nose and lungs along with other chemicals. So because it vaporizes so quickly, it's hard to contain. It can leak from storage tanks. It can get out of the thousands of valves and flanges that are in the pipes that wrap around refineries. I read somewhere that the piping at the old Sunoco plant in Philadelphia, which is now closed, but still emitting extraordinary amounts of benzene, the piping around that plant, if you stretched it out, would take you all the way to Florida. So wastewater ponds, those are other sources. You've got lots of places where benzene can get out of refineries. In 2012, we filed a lawsuit against EPA, pushing the agency to get a handle on where all that benzene is coming from and how much is reaching at least the edge of these refineries. And so in response, the agency required petroleum refineries to put these monitors in. There are a network of them. There can be anywhere from 15 to more than three dozen ringing these plants. And the data comes from those monitoring stations. The benzene is collected. You get an average for each 2-week period. And when you get more than a threshold amount, it happens to be 9 micrograms per cubic meter on an annual basis. That's where EPA drew the line. Then you have exceeded the action level and you have the responsibility to go find out where it's coming from and to get it, get those levels down. So there are some loopholes in the rule. And I'm bringing them up in part to let everyone know that the actual benzene that people are getting exposed to downwind may be higher than what's suggested by, you know, whether or not a refinery has got more benzene than this sort of acceptable limit that EPA set up. That's because when you're tallying up your annual emissions and trying to figure out, am I over that limit, you get to exclude benzene from certain sources. My favorite example is if you happen to have benzene storage tanks, and I'm talking about storing pure benzene at your refinery, and many refineries do because they engage in chemical processing as a side business, the emissions from those benzene tanks don't count when you are trying to figure out whether or not you've met your, you know, whether or not you've triggered or crossed over the acceptable limit. You can subtract the benzene from benzene tanks because they happen not to be covered by this particular refinery rule. If you've got a monitoring plan that's been approved by EPA, you can subtract benzene that you think comes from an offsite facility, even if the same company owns that offsite facility. So there are some loopholes that need attention in this rule and suggest that the actual data shows the benzene numbers are quite a bit higher than the levels that are used to sort of trigger the duty to go find out where the benzene's coming from and cleaning it up. You could be reading 20 micrograms of benzene at your fence line. That's the actual concentration. By the time you finish subtracting the offsite sources, the benzene tanks, and so on, you could end up with 4 or 5 micrograms on an annual basis. And if you can do that, then you don't have to do anything under the rule. So that needs fixing. One of the reasons this matters so much is more than 500,000 people live within 3 miles of one of the 13 plants that have exceeded the action level. And about 60% are people of color. That's of the total population. I don't think that will surprise most of the people on this call. And the communities, the residents of those communities live on limited incomes by and large. These are exactly the places that got hurt the hardest by the pandemic. These are exactly the places where people are already struggling with pre-existing health conditions that make them more vulnerable to pollutants like benzene. So we have President Biden saying that environmental justice will be at the center of everything we do. And we are suggesting today the administration start here. this is a great place to, start keeping that promise. Some of the things that EPA could do is we have concentrations at the fence line. We need to know how much is getting into the communities downwind. In many of these, in most of these locations, you've got people living within a block or two of the plants. So, sometimes it may be as far as a half a mile, but pretty close to the sources. We can do a better job of taking the benzene numbers that get reported at the fence line and figuring out who's getting exposed downwind. We can also put more monitors into those communities. The monitoring equipment that refineries are using is very inexpensive, and the government should require that more of those monitors are actually placed where people live. That would be very, very helpful and give people a better idea of what they're getting exposed to. So that's important. One of the things we found in our study is that while the rule looks at annual concentrations of benzene, the industry reports benzene concentrations every 2 weeks. And some of those short-term benzene concentrations are really, really high. So maybe to put that in context, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health says that if benzene concentrations exceed its 100 parts per billion, but for comparison, that amounts to 320 micrograms per cubic meter, within 10 hours, that workers exposed to those levels should be wearing respirators. It's that dangerous. We have two-week concentrations at the perimeter of these refineries over a two-week period recording benzene concentrations greater than the amount you're supposed to be exposed to for just 10 hours. That's pretty alarming. Levels that high should get reported right away. The community should be informed, and EPA and states and the refineries need to be scrambling to find out why that monitor heated up with so much benzene in such a short period of time. The final thing I want to close with is it's really great to have the fence line monitoring data. The idea in getting that data was that it would drive cleanup of benzene emission sources. We have seen some of that at some plants where we have, and we tell you, where we've seen benzene levels come down, but more refineries exceeded the action level this year, 13, than did at the end of 2019, when there were just 11. So that's going in the wrong direction. As I said earlier, these high levels have persisted at some of these refineries for more than 2 years in a row. The data is supposed to drive action. It's supposed to drive cleanup. We're asking EPA to step in and exercise its enforcement authority and get these numbers down, drive these numbers down at refineries where we already know they're too high. So thanks for your time, and Tom, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks so much. That was Eric Schaefer. His last name is spelled S-C-H-A-E-F-F-E-R. Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project. Our next speaker is Ann Rolfes, Director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. Her name is spelled A-N-N-E-R-O-L-F-E-S. Ann Rolfes. Go ahead, Ann.
Thanks a lot, Tom and Eric, and thanks for doing this work. I run a group called the Bucket Brigade, and we work here in Louisiana with communities that are impacted by petrochemical pollution. And so, unfortunately, I am familiar with a number of these refineries. 17 years ago, in 2004, I was working with a community next to Chalmette Refining, one of the refineries in this report, working with a group called St. Bernard Citizens for Environmental Quality. They lived in the neighborhood, which still exists, Chalmette Vista, right across the street from Chalmette Refining. So there are people right there, right in the way. At the time, we filed a Clean Air Act lawsuit in 2004. And a couple of years later, a federal judge named Sarah Vance, that unless something happened, unless there was some sort of intervention, that the violations that she found in our lawsuit were likely to continue. So 17 years later, that judge now looks as if she can see the future. In fact, the problems have continued for all this time. At that time, there was a leaking benzene tank right across the street from a Montessori preschool. And if you look at this report, you see that that situation is really scarily similar to the refinery that we see today in Krotz Springs, where one of the worst offenders here is right near a daycare and right near an elementary school. So I give this story, I think, to make the obvious point that not only has this been a problem for a very long time, but that we've known it, and that a judge even saw it and inscribed that in her ruling. And so here are my takeaways from this information that really we only know because Ben and Eric and the rest of the team at EIP took the time to do this report. So we thank them for that. Just to put a finer point on it, we really only know this because groups worked for what, almost a decade to get this refinery monitoring rule in place. But two things for me. One is our Department of Environmental Quality is clearly incompetent and it should lose its delegated authority that the Environmental Protection Agency granted our state agency to run the air program. As you can see in the chart, that's early in the report, Louisiana is the worst, right? We have 5 refineries on this list. There are 17 total refineries in this state. So that means that almost a third of our refineries have this problem. And truly, if you consider the loophole that the report explains, my guess is that it's more refineries than 5. But clearly we're in a calamitous situation here in Louisiana with 5 refineries on this list. And not just on this list, but at really, really high levels. Again, the number one on the list is 246% higher over the action level, right? It's called an action level for a reason, and yet obviously that has triggered no action by our State Department of Environmental Quality. And from my point of view, if you want to know why Louisiana leads so many of the bad lists for health and for wealth, look no further than this, right? We're allowing these facilities to pump out chemicals that we know are dangerous. And then the second dynamic is that EPA has the authority to act. Eric said it. It's on page 7 in the report. We need them to come in and take action. Clearly, it's an endemic problem here in Louisiana when we've been looking at it for 20 years, and that's just since I've been on the scene. I'm sure it's actually longer. It's an endemic, systemic, deep-rooted problem. And so it was going to require a long, hard look and a real plan to fix it. And Biden is talking about environmental justice, talking about climate justice, and it's going to require not just a cursory glance or a chit chat with our state agency, but a deep review. And what we hope is a takeover of our state agency. Just a final point, you know, for Krotz Springs, who's going to tell them about this report? I mean, maybe I'll call the daycare. I don't know. I mean, it's terrible. How are they even going to know that they're in danger? And then just to make a point that in 2001, so 20 years ago, we were catching benzene air samples next to the Shell refinery that's in this report. So all over the place, this is a long-rooted problem that needs significant attention and action by EPA. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. That was Anne Rolfes, director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. His name is spelled R-O-L-F-E-S. Next, we're going to have Patricia Gonzalez, founder of Caring for Pasadena Communities, located just outside of Houston. Her last name is spelled G-O-N-Z-A-L-E-Z, Patricia Gonzalez. Go ahead, Patricia. Oh, you're muted. You're muted. Let's unmute you.
Thank you for having me.
Great.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I work in the Pasadena area along the 225 corridor into 45 heading into Houston. What our organization does is tries to educate and teach the public on how they can respond to companies that are going beyond the excessive level that they're supposed to be going on as far as polluting the air, or like now with the benzene happening. And our refinery, which is a Pasadena refinery on the other side of the 225 corridor, we find that they consecutively exceed limits in different pollutions. It's not just only benzene, and the EPA is not doing anything about it. So what we're trying to do is educate the people around that community and let them know this is what's going on. You need to jump on board with us so that we can do something about it. If it is to file a lawsuit against the EPA for them to take action on this refinery, then so be it. But, or if it's just us filing a lawsuit against the refinery itself, but anything that we can do that will help eliminate these problems that this particular refinery keeps doing. And, you know, I'm glad to hear that Biden is wanting to talk about environmental justice, because what happens is that the minorities and the low-income families are the ones that live around these refineries. And our thing has always been that no refinery would be around any public schools, daycares, churches, homes, within a 25-mile radius. But that's not what's happening. What's happening is it's so much shorter in the miles that where the refineries are into where the people are living, or if there's a school or daycare. So we need to let the public know this is dangerous and how they can themselves help us take effect on what can be done on these type of issues. And, you know, I like the idea of Biden saying what he said, but the thing is that if we don't put it down in writing and start with the EPA on up, then we're not going to get anywhere. Because like I said, this particular refinery keeps getting fined for different pollutants. And now I'm hoping to also with this report, I see that we're one of the ones in Texas. I want to see that changed. I want to see them reduce the limits of the benzene on top of other pollutants that they're already getting fined for.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was Patricia Gonzalez, founder of Caring for Pasadena Communities. Our next speaker is going to be Cade Kistler, program director at the Mobile Baykeeper in Alabama. His name is spelled C-A-D-E-K-I-S-T-L-E-R, Cade Kistler, with the Mobile Baykeeper. Go ahead, Cade.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, and thanks to Environmental Integrity Project for having us and for doing the work to put this report together. You know, Mobile Baykeeper is an environmental nonprofit. We've been working for over 24 years to protect the beauty, health, and heritage of Mobile Bay and our coastal community. So we work on all kinds of issues, working for clean water, clean air, and healthy communities in this area. Air is a big focus for us, obviously, because it has big impacts on the health of our communities and those that live around facilities that are producing air pollution. So, you know, I think the report that y'all generated and the data that it shows that these refineries have benzene levels at their fence line, at the outside of the facility, closest to where the communities are located, that exceed this action level is you know, pretty cut and dry. So, you know, my remarks are going to be brief in that. If you have a rule that says when you exceed this action level, you need to do a root cause analysis and you need to stop the pollution, right? And that's what the EPA rule essentially says, then that's what needs to happen, you know, as soon as possible, and not necessarily, you know, waiting until a year later and coming back and saying, hey, we might need to deal with this. When you're seeing levels like at the Shell Chemical facility in Saraland that were over 92.4, micrograms per liter, anyway, 10 times the action level, you know, that's when those facilities, and specifically the facility outside of Saraland, need to take action, right? And they need to perform that root cause analysis, investigate what's causing those problems, and protect the nearby communities, protect their health. And so that's, you know, that's where we stand on this, is that clearly the rule says that when these action levels are exceeded, these facilities need to take action and stop the pollution. And so we expect that Shell Chemical Refinery and any other of the refineries that are mentioned in this report need to investigate what's causing those repeated high concentrations of benzene at their fence lines and protect the nearby communities. So that is our stance on this. And we, again, appreciate Environmental Integrity Project's work on this report.
Thanks so much. That was Cade Kistler, Program Director at Mobile Baykeeper. Our final speaker is Danny Parent, Communications Co-Director for the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, based in Kentucky and West Virginia. Her name is spelled Danny, D-A-N-I, Parent, P-A-R-E-N-T. Go ahead, Danny.
Hello, thank you so much, Tom, for having us, and thank you to everyone who put in the work on this report. Again, my name is Dani Parent. I'm the communications co-director at the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. I grew up in Catlettsburg, Kentucky, and currently live just a few miles upriver in Huntington, West Virginia. My charge at OVEC is narrative change. We do a lot of work disseminating information like this report and trying to center the narrative around the folks who are affected rather than the industry's narrative. So I apologize, my marks are kind of informed by that. I grew up in a place called the Chemical Valley. It is so named because of the concentration of chemical plants down the river from Charleston, West Virginia to Catlettsburg, Kentucky. The trains going in and out of the refinery shook the windows of my childhood bedroom. Odd smells, vapor, and smoke above the tree line, respiratory problems, and cancer are the rule, not the exception. I grew up in a poor and vulnerable place. Right around 30% of folks in Catlettsburg meet the criteria to be considered impoverished. And according to census data, 19% of people under 65 are considered disabled compared to 8.6% nationwide. I come from people who are poor, sick, and who need their health and their bodies to work, but are simultaneously forced to work in environments with hazardous conditions. People are desperate, but that's the case for most places so affected by environmental justice issues. I grew up in a place where there are really only two career paths if you don't want to move away, the hospital or the refinery. Both of these are beloved and hated, known for corruption, pollution, and history of fickle employers, but seen as the only real path to making a living. It's also quietly acknowledged that their relationship is a symbiotic one. I grew up in a place where people don't trust the air they breathe or the water they drink, and they're right not to trust because many times their air and water are toxic, as proved by this report, as they're constantly reminded by the stacks on the horizon and multiple boil water advisories every month. It was no surprise to me to find that benzene concentrations in the air around Catlettsburg were up 233% from 2019 to 2020. No surprise because that's what folks in the Chemical Valley learned to expect. The cycle of crisis and remediation and public relations repeated ad nauseum. It was also no surprise to learn that the EPA's monitoring rules may be causing the obscuring of some of these benzene levels. The chemical industry moved in after the coal industry died out, and we're used to the industry controlling the narrative and imposing their wills. I grew up in a place that deserves better, with people who deserve better, and that begins with effective regulation and monitoring from the EPA. Thank you.
All right, thanks so very much. That was Dani Parent with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. John Beard from Port Arthur. Yeah. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Go ahead, John. Unmute yourself and give us your thoughts.
Yes, first of all, thank you. Sorry, I wasn't able to get in on time. But you're exactly right. One of the key things or indicators we had here in Port Arthur was that the EPA in 2010, in pronouncing Port Arthur to be one of its showcase cities, made the announcement to us that we had twice the state and national average for certain types of cancer, as well as heart, lung, and kidney disease. We've known to have been in air quality non-attainment for quite a number of years, and especially so near the fence line communities. What has not taken place has been a study to see exactly what those links are, but we do know the types of pollutants that have been emitted. We also know the length of time of exposure that most of those people have had, and their distance from that. So by whatever means that were involved or used by EPA, they found that to be the case. And we're finding it to be the case when you talk to local public health officials and just in general, you know, getting anecdotal information from people you talk to. I have a saying that I tell people about my little city here, that if you come here and you meet someone, and you ask them if they're from Port Arthur, the question next should be asked is whether they know of anyone who has had cancer or has died from cancer or is in remission or treatment from cancer. And I can assure you, in a city of little over 50,000 people, you will not find a single person who's spent any length of time here who will tell you no, they know of nobody, no such person. That's just how rampant it is in our community. And matter of fact, I was in a meeting earlier dealing with some of those very same health issues and concerns. So we have to look at what these emissions are, even though there's a lot of self-reporting. We have to look at what some of the fugitive emissions are that come from these plants and all of that. And we have to look at what the overall health of the community is and what's being done to help those communities. And it becomes very graphically clear that those communities of color and others that are along the fence line are being unduly impacted by these emissions from these plants. This one last thing, and I'm gonna hand this over to someone else. During one of the more recent storms we had back in last year, August of last year, Hurricane Laura, one of my organization, PECON's members, was contacted after the storm. And we were all, you know, doing a checkup with each one. And she mentioned that during the night that the emissions from one of those plants, there was a foul odor in the air. She lives two blocks from the fence line of a major company. And we had some others on board with Environment Texas and other groups. They called these companies and tried to get reports. And all of them said, oh, no, no problem at all. Everything went fine. But the local newspaper picked up on the fact that they did indeed have a leak during the course of shutting down that facility. And they listed a number of substances, particulate matter, SO2, and benzene. Well, now what's important about this is that this lady lives two blocks from the fence line, is recovering from cancer. Her husband has just recovered late last year from his final cancer treatments, and he weighs less than 125 pounds now. She has a brother she buried 3 months ago who died from cancer. Her daughter is a cancer survivor. And you know, a lot of people like to move back home after they move away and make their fortune and do what they do and decide to come back home and spend their retirement years. And she had two of her very close childhood friends who moved back. One has since died of cancer within a year of returning to Port Arthur. And the other person has been found to have had cancer. And what's worse is she's been discovered to possibly be having thyroid cancer, and she's being treated or being diagnosed for that now. All that to say that these communities are impacted severely, and more studies have to be done and appropriated on the state and federal level to make sure that there is no, if there isn't, a connection between those exposures and those releases that happen routinely and the health of the people that live in those cities and especially near the fence line.
Thank you. That was John Beard, founder of the Port Arthur Community Action Network. And we're now at the 1 hour mark. So I think we're gonna wrap it up. Thank you very much to everyone who participated in today's event.